Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Is JJ. Who is this?
This is Walter Green, University of Arkansas.
Hey, Walter, how are you?
Good.
I see a couple other people in the documents, so I'm presuming they'll be calling in.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello, this is Joost Melson from the Netherlands.
Oh, how are you, Joost?
I'm fine,
You
thank you.
great. We're just starting to get people on the call, and so we'll give people a couple of minutes to call in, and then we'll get started.
Okay.
All right, I hear a bunch of beeps. I'm hoping that's people arriving and not hanging up. I think we got lucky on our time zone determination. I
For
was
me, it's a
worried there
good
would
time.
be It seemed to be a good time. I was just worried, given the difference of time zones, that I might have miscalculated for someone.
Not to worry.
We'll give another minute. It sounds like we have a decent number of callers, which is exciting. Okay, I think we might as well get started. I just want to make sure, is Mr. Vierda on, the author? We'll give him a moment to call in.
JJ, I don't know if you're taking attendance, but this is Keith. I'm on my mobile, and then I'll switch over once I get to the office.
Okay. I don't know if I'll take attendance necessarily,
right.
But we'll
right.
do a general roll call just to see who's on the line.
JJ, this is Pete. If you want, we could put attendees into the Google Doc.
If they wanted to self-register, that'd be fine. Sure.
If that's helpful. Just so Mr. Weird, I can kind of see people's names. It's always hard when you're on a phone.
Yes. So do we have... All right, we hear a couple more people calling in. So do we have the author, Mr. Vierda, on the line as of yet?
Not here yet.
Hello?
This is Dana from Miami.
Oh,
Daniel
hi, Dana.
Bob.
I'm just waiting to make sure we have the author online.
Sounds good.
And if he doesn't call in a minute or two, I do have a direct line to him. I'll try to call him on there. And I will do that just to make sure we don't have some sort of technical difficulty. Hello, I'm just wondering who just joined the call.
Well, hi, I'm Kerry Davis from Cardiff Uni.
Okay, thank you. We're just waiting for the author to join us. I'm going to give him a call just to make sure he's not having the troubles at all. All right, if people can hold on a second, I'm giving him a call right now.
If you're on the call and not yet in the Google Doc, there's a link to it in the email that JJ sent out yesterday. And if you are in the Google Doc, feel free to add your name to the list of attendees. That just helps the author see who's on the call.
All right, this is JJ again. I just got a hold of the author. He will be calling in momentarily. So I thank everyone for their patience. And let's see. I guess while we're waiting to call in, I do believe we have his colleague, Joost, on the line. Is that true?
Yes, that's me.
All right. I didn't catch your last name. I'm sorry.
Melson.
Nelson. Okay, great. And we are very happy to have you joining us also. My understanding is that you now work as an EA in higher education?
I'm the lead IT architect for Leiden University in the Netherlands.
Oh, that's great. As you may have known, this group is called ITANA, and we're a group of architects, IT, enterprise, other types of architects that get together and discuss topics related to higher education. And we do have
right.
a website called ITANA, ITANA.org, if you want to take a look at it, and you're free to join it. We would love to have more members. We have a decent number.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be on your call tonight, and I'll certainly look on your website.
Hello?
Hello, is this Mr. Vierda?
Yeah, Herman. Just say Herman.
Ah, okay. Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, or this
mm-hmm.
evening, as the case may be. I think what we'll do is we'll get started here without any further ado. It sounds like we have a fair number of people on the line. So
okay.
I think what we'll do is just kind of go through quickly just to see who's on the line. We'll just as quickly as possible. And we'll just go from who's on the line from, I guess, on the east side of the Atlantic, so in Europe.
Okay. Well,
that's probably
do I need an introduction or?
You do not need an introduction.
Oh, also, you read my book.
Yes. And we know
yes,
we have Joost on the
line. From the UK, so it's Kerry Davis from Cardiff University in Wales. I'm the head of IT architecture, which is a nefarious title, a bit of enterprise architecture's practice. And I also own solutions architecture.
All right. Anyone else from the eastern side of the Atlantic? If we're not, we'll come over to this side, to the western side of the Atlantic, starting the east coast of the United States.
Dana, Bob, and Daniel from Miami University.
Dan Kiskis, University of Michigan.
Yes, sir.
All right. Anyone central time zone?
This is Walter Green, University of Arkansas.
Betsy Draper, Kansas State University.
Keith Hazelton, University of Wisconsin-Madison.
All right, we have JJ, myself, JJ Duchateau, University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Lonnie Smetana, University of Manitoba.
All right, anyone else from Central? If not, moving on to Mountain. No one in the Mountain time zone, Pacific.
This is Pete Niederhausen at the University of Washington.
Rupert Burke, University of Washington.
And then anyone that that we missed? We know a couple callers after we started. All right. Well, thank you everyone for calling in. I guess I want to approach this into basically two parts. Maybe a short background by Gerben on how he came about with this chess approach, how well it's working, and any changes he might have thought of or implemented since he's written and published the book. And then we'll move on to some of the questions to the document that everyone should have a copy of. And then any other questions besides that? We'll try to keep this somewhat informal. So I'm going to turn it over to Gerben. And I apologize. I am probably butchering the pronunciation of your name.
No, it's fine. First, it's fine, and secondly, I'm used to it. So,
as I like to tell people, I have a tough enough time with just English. So Getting me to work with additional languages and pronunciations is a trial for me. But I would we'd love to have you get us started and you know, a little background about the book.
All right. Well, first, I'll thank you for having me, because I'm always interested in discussions like this. Can you hear me well?
I can.
Yeah? Sound is okay? Okay.
Great. Very good from here.
Okay. First, also, apologies. You know, you mispronouncing my name is easy. Probably I'll do more harm to the English language as we go along. So my apologies for that. With the book and the methodology is that I have been always very unhappy with what enterprise architecture professed to do, because I was in many situations and I never saw it really work. And always the excuse was that it was politics or it was something else, and at some point I came to the conclusion that, and I don't know how, but at some point I had to explain enterprise architecture to somebody who was coming in as a manager, and he had no background in anything related to this. The guy was a mortgage guy. And so I had to explain it to him. And then I was always struggling with how do I explain to people, the fact that it is so complex and the fact that it is so so unpredictable by times. And then kind of the chess analogy struck me. And it kind of gave me a good focus to actually explain what it was about. So it also helped me. And this was, by the way, halfway that I was actually doing it. So I did not think of the chess metaphor at the start. It came halfway. And it gave me a couple of kind of starting points to address some of the weaknesses I thought there were in what I would call the orthodox enterprise architecture, which of course I've written down in the book, things like the fact that every time you do an end state or a future state, it never comes to pass, because that kind of planning, we are in a world which is so moving and unpredictable, and it's so complex that we cannot do enough to do it actually right. That it's kind of a hopeless thing, and from the whole complexity idea and the fact that you can't do this, in a simple way, it cannot be simplified. That's more or less the feeling that was behind it. Came the point that in the end it's about making one good move at a time. Again, that's something that kind of struck me afterwards when I thought of the chess metaphor. That it was really fitting. So that's more or less how it came to be. And a very important driver was being very aware of the fact that it was impossible for me to know it all, and that there was no way I could do this right. Make kind of go for the right decisions, go for the right solutions, etc., because I would be unable to match. And this was really enforced by the horrible complexity of the asset management world I came into. It's probably from all the situations I've been into, I've encountered there the most complex I've encountered anywhere. So that also drove it home. It was impossible for me to actually have a meaningful role as an enterprise architect, because there was always so much that I didn't know and that had to be taken into account, and I could not simplify it and still be useful. So that's how it came about. And it started really from a very simple practical thing, like, I want a basic feeling that any effort you put into design is rewarded with a lot of less hassle and problems afterwards. Even if the future is unpredictable and you cannot know what's going to happen and all kind of strange things happening during change initiatives and transformations and so forth. So I thought, well, if you do design beforehand, then you have to focus on kind of, you know, think backward. What are the things that make the whole thing go wrong, and then try to address them? And so that's kind of the way it all started. Does that explain a little bit how it came to be?
Yes, it does. For what you have discussed in your book on how a better way to approach enterprise architecture, how is that mm-hmm. working out for you today? And since you've written the book, has there been any changes, any minor tweaks or any things where you have a different approach or thought process?
Well, there's one thing I've been thinking a lot of about changes, because the book is more or less focused on the world of, say, we have a clear project, which is still always the case, budgetary things and the way organizations work. But the whole design thing, and especially the a lot of design up front, even if I myself were not of the conviction that you have to design everything up front, it's impossible to do that. But the whole agile thing is kind of making it very difficult to find a good place for the interventions you want in a checks and balances approach on enterprise architecture, right? It's the basic approach for the solution is first you work together, and the second one is it's a checks and balances thing. Let's be clear who is responsible for what and who wants what, so that we, in the end, actually from that clarity can actually talk with each other about what drives us and then come to some kind of a common understanding, and if not, have a process to actually make a decision, even if we don't have understanding. So agile is one issue which I've been paying quite a lot of attention to, because also in our organization we are moving ahead with agile rather in a big way, right? Everything must be agile, everything must be DevOps. And the question then arises, but what about architecture? Because if you, in a lot of places, agile is just kind of a lame excuse not to do architecture at all, but just, push out solutions as quickly as you can. So I've been thinking about that. I've been reading a very interesting thing of Philip Crofton about that. And his kind of idea to look at it is something I'm probably going to write a blog article about soon. And then if there ever will be a second edition of the book, I'll probably work that into the book. But generally only after I've had experience with it. So first we have, first I have to convince my organization to do it the way I've thought to do, and then I have to have some experience with if it works or not. So with respect to how it has been working, well, as you can gather from the last real chapter of the book, and the hurdles chapter, it was not easy, and it was also not always a 100% success story. There are a lot of troubles. So we've seen enough as a team to conclude that it actually did work. However, in the end, there were all kinds of, political pressures, parts of the organization that didn't want to work that way, that had different ideas, that said, kind of a project management approach, we're going to exclude everybody else and then go into our own silo and manage everything, and the silo got bigger and bigger. And this was a real fight, and the fight was also in times not really a nice fight, it was not a very productive fight. So in the end, in 2014, I moved away from the asset management APG, and I moved over to another part of APG, and that was the pressure of the large project and the higher management behind it, that where I had the role to actually, there was a problem situation in the governance there,
that the person from the board who was responsible for enterprise architecture was the same person who was responsible for that project, which was going really, really horribly wrong. And it was my task to actually all the time put that in, on the agenda. And so that kind of every time I did it, every time I said the things that had to be said about that project, I was actually, you know, fighting my own boss. And that was that was not doable in the long run. So at some point he had to choose, and because of all the political pressures he was under, he said, "When I am, you know, I'm going to, you know, you have to go." So the interesting thing about that was that that didn't save the project. So the guy who was responsible for the project left half a year later, but not after my team has said, "Well, this is so unfair, we leave too." So the whole thing, the whole team, then collapsed. The interesting thing is that then 1 year later they came back to me and they said, "We have nobody anymore who understands a bit of asset management and enterprise architecture. Can you please help us?" And given that this is all, you know, professional-like, I said, "Of course I will." So I've been working with them again, but keeping a little bit of a distance. And in the same time, I'm doing my utmost best to do have this kind of an approach on the IT department, which has also seen some success in terms of, you know, I have an enterprise architecture group, and their average score they get from the business is on a scale from 1 to 10, is the average for the whole team is an 8, which means that everybody's very happy with the kind of the value we bring to actually getting them get their work done. So it's going slowly, it's always more slowly than you want, in the right direction. But again, it has not been an unmitigated success because there were political realities.
So it has been successful, but there will be some progress followed by some setbacks, followed by more progress and more setbacks.
All the projects that have played along the checks and balances with the architecture board, the project architectures, the discussions, the working together, etc., all of them that I can say in that period of 3 years were within time and under budget, and kind of delivering everything they wanted to deliver. Those projects that said, "We can go faster without you guys, we don't need you," they all went horribly over but time and budget. And so the year before I went, we had two big managers who actually were fighting this extra influence because they saw it as something negative, right? Something holding them back because they wanted to make haste and speed. One of these actually, in the end, said, "No, I've said I want this judgment, so I'm going to get it." And then he listened, he did about it, and suddenly his project started to run. Then he became the head of the other project, and the other guy became kind of the senior supplier, and they started fighting amongst each other, and in that fight, we kind of got grinded. So we got ground to dust, which happens.
All right. So that gives us a great background, great starting point for some of our questions. I don't know if you had a chance to glance at the ones that I sent to you. Okay, and so maybe we just go through those. The answers don't necessarily be long, but we can go from there. So I'm looking at the document. The first question has to do with the two different orthodoxies that you mentioned that tend to fail due to their structure. And the question is is this failure, do you think, more to rigidity in following that structure, where maybe success could have happened if collaboration was more emphasized and people went outside of the boxes on that structure?
Yeah, I understand where the question is coming from, and I have a very simple answer about this. The answer for me is I don't think it's to a lot of extent. And the reason for that is you make structures and you make responsibilities, etc., not for the moment that everybody agrees, not for the time that everybody agrees about what has to be done. You you make these structures for the times, for the moments that people disagree. Because you need a way to actually productively work together to resolve your differences. That's what this is about. As long as everybody agrees, every structure works, because everybody automatically works together. So why does the other structure doesn't work? Because there is no kind of there is no room for the differences of opinion to play out in a nice way. If you have your single architecture or your design office that designs everything, you still have two bosses. And if those bosses have requirements that don't agree or are impossible to agree, then you have to have a conflict resolution. And if then you don't have a process to actually have both sides of the issue clearly in that process, which you have if it's just one single person, then you get all kinds of conflicts of loyalty, et cetera, et cetera. So even if you want to be, you know, you can go a long way, of course, by doing things like being, your attitude being collaborative, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, the structure which we had really helped us to actually find out where we did disagree, if we actually disagreed, or if it was just a misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge, and move us forward. Whereas in the other structures, and in both of which I have worked in the past, you never had that. You never had the orthodoxy one doesn't work because actually you're so far removed from anything which is an important decision that your real influence on what's going on in the landscape is almost zero. And orthodoxy two, kind of, you know, there are always differences of opinion. There are always differences of estimation, etc. And these have to be resolved. And if you don't have a process where these can be, you know, really clear, it's very, very difficult. You put a very big load on the one person who is going to do that. There might be, you know, very good architects who are also very good diplomats who can do it. However, in the case of, you know, situations where most people are normal people and not Superman or Superwoman, then the structure really helps you to actually resolve those differences. So that would be my answer to question number one.
All right, so when it's a happy flow, then it doesn't really matter. But when the happy flow doesn't exist, that's when the structure is important.
That's why you have it, because why do you have enterprise architecture? Why don't you leave all these, you know, transformations and projects and programs go on happily, you know, doing their own thing? The reason you have that is because if you do that, you know, you got a cauldron of evolution. However, evolution is very, very wasteful.
Go ahead.
JJ, I was going to say, this is Keith. I had a kind of a follow-up to that, I think. Gerben, it seems that a situation architecture finds itself in very often with regard to a project, even if we've got fairly good relationships with the principals in that project, we end up in a situation where the architectural advice, which is really motivated by more the holistic picture and what's good for the greater organization, is at odds with, again, timeline and budget of the project. And
exactly.
The project managers are absolutely paid and judged on, you know, time and budgets. So I keep wondering if in our own situation, the central, I guess what we would call the architectural board, or even the university as a whole, doesn't have a kind of pot of resources to defray the cost of doing it, quote unquote, the right way. So, and I keep thinking if we had that, you could essentially there would be carrots to offer. Right now, we really don't have carrots, and of course, we don't have sticks, right? So.
That's one of the interesting things there is that you don't have the direct, you know, visible cards to offer, because solving the defects quick and easy way, creating features in a quick and easy way in some kind of a solution you're after. That's what everybody sees, right? And the architectural things, though, and the opposite, the negative of the architectural things, like the technical debt you're actually creating, which is, I think, a very, very useful concept. That's something that that the architecture is about, right? If you have a good architecture overall, then you kind of you have potential features in the future, and you have you're actually able to move, you're flexible, etc., etc. So my strategy in that has always been to actually talk with the people who decide on the top, who actually give both orders, right? They give border, they give the orders for, they are the executives who say, do this project, and at the same time, they're the executives who say, I want this perfect landscape. To actually make sure that they understand that the choices they, if they give these two things and they are conflicting, that if the, if say I as a lead architect and a project executive of a large project or transformation, etc., and we come into this process and we both come from two different kind of goals which we both inherit from, say, a board above, and we are unable to solve that, then we have to go up. And that's actually something that that has, you know, providing that clarity, that I have seen working, right? So you go back to the top, you say to the top, listen, you have given this project such and such amount of money and time. However, if they go ahead like this, they are going to produce this kind of a technical debt, which in the future is going to really hurt you, potentially. And then, of course, in the end, it can be that they say, well, yeah, we would really like to do it, you know, the right way, but we don't have the money. And at that point, I as an architect, I can only say, well, I've told you what the risk is that you're running, or even sometimes the certainty of what you're running, of the result of what you're doing. But if you still want to go ahead, you're the boss. So for you, it's probably a calculated risk, and maybe you don't believe me or whatever. And what happens is that this takes time. So the first year that you're doing this, and even the second year that you're doing this, they are kind of, this guy, you know, he's making too much, you know, he's too negative, he's too pessimistic, it's going to work, etc., etc. However, if after a while it turns out that every time you have said something that has, you know, come true, then they start to pay attention. So it's kind of, it takes time. And here is a kind of a catch 20. It's not so much a it's kind of a catch 22 in this sense that management changes all the time. So you get people, you know, after 3 years they go and they do something else, and new management comes in, and you have to start all over again. So that makes it really difficult. I don't have a really good answer for this. Sometimes it's just a matter of plain luck and being able to convince people.
And that, I think your last point, Gerben, is quite helpful, especially for us in the higher education institutions, where we tend to be very collaborative by nature, with very much consensus decision making and influence, but not necessarily, you know, authority, power, decision makers. You know, going to an executive doesn't always get those results in a university environment, given the federated nature of that environment. And I think that leads into the second question that we have, where you state that on page 149, if people argue that they should not strive for power, but they should build consensus, they're missing the point. Given the nature of a university environment, how might we approach this, given our cultural reality, in adapting some of your ideas?
I have a story about this, and this is for a longer time ago. I think it's about 15, 20 years ago. I went to talk to a university department, and this was a big, you know, This was computer science, math, et cetera, et cetera. And they also, of course, they had their infrastructure. And they were looking for a new manager, a new IT manager. They had just dropped the previous manager. And the previous manager, he had come in after the one before. The one before, he was very unsuccessful. He didn't get anything done. It was still a complete chaos. So when this manager, before I was going to talk there, came in, he said, I really want authority. I really want authority. Now, these were professors who were foremost in their fields worldwide in the computer science, right? It's not even that you're talking with people from, say, law or linguistics or whatever, but really from computer science. And he said, I want to have the authority to actually deny them something or to force them to do something, whatever, for security, for this, for that. And they gave it to her. And then what he did was he actually used that power in a directive way. And that turned to very ugly to a war. So I said to them, you know, so they wanted a new person. And I said, we're not going to give someone that power anymore because he has to convince people. And the problem is really, it's almost a matter of, say, biological economics. If I don't have anything to say, there's also nothing I can give away, which means that the way you actually use that authority, that's important. And in the process I've described in the book, what I've made very clear is that I cannot stop a project. I cannot say this architecture is not allowed. In fact, I don't have any real authority. However, the process demands that I have my say about it. And if I say this is, you know, a showstopper, you shouldn't do this because it's going to go horribly wrong, then the process says you should not have that on your designs. You should not have that status from enterprise architecture on your design. So it becomes very important for people to actually make sure that you don't get that, which is why if I do a review, I always say, well, there are all kinds of things I would say, this could be done better, this better, this better, this better. But, you know, if you go ahead with it, would I say, don't do it because everything will fall apart? No. But sometimes you come across something that you say, no, this is really not how we should do it. If we do it like this, experience tells us this is going to horribly fail and cost millions of dollars or euros or whatever. Okay. And that's the moment I withhold my approval. But in my system, that doesn't mean they can't go ahead. They can still go ahead, only they go ahead without approval. And then the question is, how important is that? How important is it that there is not that approval? Well, it's also that top management that has said, we want a system that gives that approval. They still can go ahead, right? They have to talk. And then you come, what I said earlier, then there might be, you know, differences or of estimation or it are impossible choices or whatever, and then they make a decision and you go ahead. So it's not the authority in terms of that you are the police, the gatekeeper, but you are there because you actually are guarding something which is important for the organization. And only when the organization is constantly reminded but also agrees that this is important, and by the way, on paper at the water cooler, they all will agree. The big problem is that they never go ahead with it, right? Everybody says, we're in favor of architecture, and then nobody actually pays attention.
So
to actually make sure that the process is that they have to explain themselves if this kind of a difference of opinion is, you know, glaringly visible on the fact that a design has not gotten the approval, has worked actually really well. Whereas actually what you do as an enterprise architect, or what I do then, is nothing more than an advice. So the authority doesn't come from actually being able to say no and then it doesn't happen. But it comes from having to say no and then everybody kind of recognizing that is an important thing that we have to do something about.
So for those places in higher education that maybe a ways away from having senior leadership accountability and agreement and ability to delegate, is that sort of consultation an interim model that might make sense, or what type of things would you suggest as an interim model and a way to make progress?
The question, of course, is who has a problem if there is no enterprise architecture? If nobody has a problem, then the situation is, first, it's hopeless, and second, fine, no problem. However, there will always be people who actually are aware of the fact that they are having problems. For instance, changes are too expensive, takes too long, there are all kinds of things that don't work, etc., etc. So at some point, as long as there is no kind of a organizational drive to solve that problem, and as an enterprise architect, you are kind of the representative of that stake of the entire organization. So you can actually, even without, in my opinion, even without the fact that you have at the top level management which is aware and pays attention, et cetera, you still can be the one who is actually kind of the de facto owner of that thing that everybody wants.
Yeah, and there's maybe... Garvin?
Yeah?
Can I add to that? On a practical side, for interim models, you could ask yourself the question, what is the definition of enterprise in terms of domain that you're going to address? You have a strategic goal to improve research data management. Many universities have, so you could say, I want the governance for that program to be managed in an enterprise architecture way. And the enterprise architect is then the collector of concerns for all the stakeholders, making sure that they become visible in all the decisions made there. If that works, you could extend it to other areas, and then by conviction gain the influence, gain the actual power to make it that way. In my own case, at the University of Leiden, what I am currently doing is taking the infrastructure area and work with the management team of the IT department to professionalize and use architecture to steer all of our improvement projects there. I know there's much more out there, but that's for the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
All right, excellent. The next set of questions, there's a couple bullet item questions under number three. So if our best response to complexity is collaboration, what is the range of ways in which architects can collaborate, and where might we get the best benefit, in your opinion?
Wait a minute. That's all right. This is the third bullet point, right?
Yes.
For me, it is even in the situation. I am now currently in a situation that I think the governance of that part of APG where I am is not very good. So a lot of my energy goes towards trying to get this fixed, right? Trying to get a situation that we do have the proper governance. Wait a minute, my screen goes. So you can do this even in ad hoc. As an example, a while back we had two large programs. One is about security, and the other is about our networking. These guys, two important projects, multi-million projects, and they have been playing requirements hockey, requirements ping pong with each other for quite a while. Whereas the security guy said, please tell me what is possible so we can actually design our security, and the network guy say to security, please tell me what you want so we can try to design the network for it. And they've been going at that for about more than a year, without any visible progress. So what I've done at some point is say, you know, guys, this can't go on much longer. We're going to go into a couple of sessions together. You, the networking guys, you, the security guys, and I'm going to sit in there, and as I don't understand anything, you're going to explain it to me. And in four sessions, we had a complete, now maybe five sessions, of, say, 2-3 hours with some discussions in between, we had a completely set up networking and security architecture done. You know, concrete, you know, in the terms of these devices, that topology of the network, this is the way the DMZ will be attached to it, this kind of, do we have one of these or two, how do we do load balancing, all the things. There was no formal architecture board. The most difficult thing I had to do was to convince a project manager to give his people time for this. But as he was kind of, you know, as he had problems, you know, moving ahead because he was kind of, everything was stalled, they were willing to try. And it took us, I think, 2 months with 5 or 6 sessions, 5 sessions, I think, and then it was done. And it was done outside the all the regular discussion, all the regular governance that was there. And when it was done, it was written up, it was checked, et cetera, et cetera, and everyone said, this is agreed, so this is how our landscape will be. And then we presented it to the governance board, who said, all right, this is good, let's go ahead with it. So you can do this also outside the structure. If you don't have the structure, then you can do it outside. You can do it in an informal way. Just get people together and make a solution, you know, or create or design a solution.
So kind of a follow from that, the last bullet one is how do, you know, what is your opinion on how can we ensure that our interim approaches are helping enough that they're worth the investment of an architect's time?
I don't know. You know, in this case, you know, everybody in the sessions at the end was kind of so relieved that there was actually a result. How many times are people not in all kind of session or project, et cetera, and there is no, you know, everybody is kind of fighting with each other or waiting for each other, whatever, and there is no result. Results make people happy. Agreement make people happy. And if they experience it, they want more of it.
Great.
So, such an interim approach, if you make sure that in the end there is a result and everybody says, wow, you know, this process was quick, smooth, to the point. One of the things I did, for instance, was at this session at the beginning, I said, you know, somebody said, well, we have this document which was agreed upon a year ago, and the board, up to the board, it was agreed. And I said, well, I'm not interested in this, because if we have to change it, they will have to agree again. And if we don't change it, you know, we already know that we have to change it. So it's nice that the document is there, but everybody who talks about the formal improvement of the past, or who talks about then and then I didn't get that information, etc., everything that is not to the point of actually making the design decisions that we have to make is out of order. So it's not on the table. And
so
I really watched out in that process that did not happen. So as soon as that happened, I said, okay, this is not what we're going to do. What we're going to do is, what is the best solution for our organization? What do we need?
Okay.
And
so it almost seems like the keeping people happy and results is almost a customer relationship management approach that needs to be taken.
Well, I agree with.
I don't know.
Gerben, if I may. Well, as a personal note, I would say it is an architect's responsibility to keep track of the balance of positive and negative experiences that other people have of the architect. The positive experiences, I agree with Gerben, come from solving the hard problems. So the ones that have been there for a long time that lead to projects extending all the time. And if you help making clear decisions and with a good argumentation, this creates relief and also clarity on what next to do, and gives a good outlook on how to end these difficult projects.
Okay. All right, I'm going to combine 4 and 5 together. And I'm going to just go towards question number 5. It seems that the structures in the book kind of come to an approach after an initiative has been started, or an effort has been initiated, reacting to it, which sometimes can be kind of closer towards a solution architecture approach. How might the structures that you propose be used in a more proactive sense, such as enterprise architecture, helping drive what efforts should be initiated?
All right. Well, yes, the book is a lot about, actually getting what you want as results, right? And steering all the different things that happen in the organization towards that, the better landscape. Having said that, you could wonder what is the difference between solution architecture and enterprise architecture? In the sense that if I have an enterprise architecture, it only becomes reality in the form of solution architectures. So there is a relation between the two. And the relation is not so much a simple top-down that you start with, this is my design for the future, but there is a part of that, certainly. So we have had in our time a future state architecture project for enterprise architecture, where we actually talked about how is our future landscape going to be, what are the things we are going to do, etc. However, a large part of that was directed at not so much making the design decisions with the knowledge of today, but actually identifying the, where we want to be robust under uncertainty. Most of the future state approaches are really directed on kind of defining a future you want to work towards, and then it gets split into programs and projects and all the things you need to do, and you have this nice feeling about I'm in control, whereas in the reality you're not in control at all, because within 1 or 2 years rules change, laws change, the economy changes, new technology arrives, etc., etc. So it's kind of an illusion to actually be able to plan like that. So whereas if you make something that is more robust in the long term, in the terms of I have a document, and this document identifies 30 uncertainties which we can give the designers that say, whatever you do in your solution architecture and whatever project comes up, instead of telling you this is the way you have to design the solution, I'm telling you your solution has to be designed in a way that is robust under these uncertainties. And that way, that is a more, in my opinion, a more robust way of steering things. If alone I think in the book I give one example of, the company turning 180 degrees in terms of how they were looking at it. This is reality. This really happened. The company we worked for, Joost and I, they moved from world champion pension fund investor to controlled simplicity. And they did that in the existing landscape, which was built for all the crazy things you could actually invest in. Now, if you are able to find a couple of those things beforehand, then it's going to give you a lot of advantages going along. But there's still that part that you say, I want in a certain direction. Currently, our organization is going through an enormous change because we have collective pension funds and we only have 8 clients. Actually, there will be less and less money in the collecting funds. It will be more individuals. So kind of the whole organization is changing towards from a business to business to a business consumer. That's a huge change. And we have plans for that, for all the kind of things and all kinds of initiatives that we do. And we have kind of a simple overall landscape where we have these kind of functions in our landscape, like we have a data core that has this functions, we have front-facing, customer-facing things that is here, we have... But the funny thing about that is, that's not more difficult. You know, that whole landscape and the discussion about that, and the whole landscape, that's kind of, you know, it fits on a PowerPoint slide.
All right.
And nothing we can actually talk about that landscape in any detail yet at that point, so we can't do more. But we actually know what we're going to do. So now we have a data core initiative. Right, there you have your solution architecture. What's this data core have? What does it have to do in the landscape? What are its functions? How are we going to actually, you know, what kind of tools or techniques are we going to use to do this function? How are we going to link everything together, etc.? Suddenly we are in solution architecture land, and that happens really quickly. The simple stuff that fits on a single PowerPoint slide, you know, nice as it is and important as it is, it's not where the difficulties are.
All right, great. I want to try to move on to the next couple of questions because we're almost out of time. Where might we learn more about your scenario-based, risk-based strategic planning approach?
Though the guy overstates his own role in it, the book, I think I mentioned the book, is The Art of the Long View by Peter Schwartz. It's a not very large book. It's an older book, and it explains the scenario methodology.
Art of the Long, what was it? Art of the...
Art of the Long View.
Okay, Art of the Long View.
The Art of the Long View. Note, by the way, that the people who thought of this, I think originally it came from the U.S., I think from the U.S. Military. Then I think the Shell, the oil company, was the first one to really do it big time in the 70s. And they were rather successful with it. The whole book is more about the whole scenarios, the plots, et cetera, et cetera. For enterprise architecture, in my view, just going, you know, listing the identifying and listing the uncertainties you want to be robust under is 90% of the job.
Okay. Have you studied much of the system theories concepts of Deming and Akoff? And if so, do you think that can help EA with its perceived lack of value?
I'm not a specialist about it, but both, as far as my picture goes, is they come from the how do you say that? They come from, I think that Akoff comes from the statistics, or Deming. One of them comes from statistics. It's kind of, both are part of we are in control, right? That's how I see them. So how can you be in control? How can you plan? How can you optimize? How can you, et cetera, et cetera? As important as that is, and if it's possible, do it. But my personal estimation is that the complexity of the world we have created with ever more IT, especially as a driver of it, has gone beyond such approaches.
Okay.
So, yes, they are still important. Yes, if possible, do it. But approaching the organization as a system that you can actually handle through the ideas and the concepts of Deming and Akoff, I don't think that it's going to work. I think it's kind of, you know, it's related to the orthodoxy, what I call the orthodoxy. That too is a planning approach, right? I know Deming is not the originator of Plan, Do, Check, Act, but the idea that you actually can get in control of this. And I don't think I don't think that is a doable way of being in control.
Great. Thank you for that answer. We're at the top of the hour. I want to respect everyone's time. I see a couple people have added a couple other questions. trying to figure out how to reconcile that. Is there the three questions I see added is one related to role-based versus full-time architects. Do you have an opinion or recommendation about that? And then synergy between E. Go ahead.
No, I think that an architect who is not also part of his time working actually in the real solution architecture area is quickly going to lose his feel for the problems he has to actually confront. Which means that you take your best designers, you make them architects. After 3 years, they're worthless and they are they're more a problem than they are a solution. So apart from, say, a lead architect who also has a political role to play, et cetera, but I think the architect should kind of also play a role in the thing that happens on the shop floor. However, when they do, they are not at that point, they don't have the responsibility of kind of steering the overall, right? So if an architect from my team goes to the business and is in a project, then I say, goodbye, you are, for that project, you are the architect. And by the way, you have to, there are all kinds of rules and regulations we have, yes, but that's because your boss has to hold them and you're going to help them. You don't have to do that, I'm not going to steer that through you. I'm going to be your checks and balances, and I want you to come into my office and say that I'm wrong. So it's important to keep the feeling and to keep the know-how, etc., because architects without actual know-how are not very effective.
Okay. Do you see any synergy between EA and IT service management, such as ITIL?
That's a big question.
Maybe it's too big given the time.
The answer is things like that are slightly a bit changing because of DevOps and all that, right?
Yeah.
So I don't. For me, the enterprise architecture is especially about transformation and change. And it's of course I know that ITIL also has things about that, right? And that's also a difficult one because sometimes a small change which happens in an ITIL workflow turns out to be a big bottleneck in your architecture. And it's really a very difficult question to actually solve that. I don't even know if it's solvable at all.
And I think a lot of us have seen ITIL becoming very prominent in our institutions.
Yep.
Last question is, what type of criteria do you use to determine what projects are selected for an architecture review?
Sorry, somebody came in. Excuse me, yeah?
What criteria do you use to select projects for an architecture review? How do you know, what criteria to determine if a project should have a review or not?
Every project. So small, large, etc. If it's a project, it has a design, and the design is going through the review period.
Okay.
There are, of course, the things of the small changes, right? And people don't call it a project, or etc., etc. That's what I was talking about just a few minutes ago. I don't know if that's a solvable problem, but however, if we turn to Agile, it might even solve itself because you have a feature backlog. Features and defects, but you also may have, as Crofton has proposed, an architectural backlog where you have your architecture results you want to create and your technical debt defects you want to solve. And making sure that the architectural backlog becomes part of the project, solution, or domain backlog, that's kind of, if you organize that in a good way, then probably that solution kind of solves itself because you have both integrated. But I'm not certain yet if that's doable or workable, and we'll have to see.
All right. Well, thank you. We're more than 5 minutes after the top of the hour. Gerben and Jos, thank you so much for joining us. I think we all appreciate your book and your answers to our questions and taking time out of your day to discuss this with us.
No problem.
It was a pleasure, and thank you.
Yeah, well, it's fun to do. I hope. By the way, can I ask you one question?
Yes.
Because, you know, as a writer, was it fun to read?
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Because, you know,
say
of
definitely,
all the content,
yes.
We've been talking the content an hour, but as a writer, what you want is that your readers actually enjoy themselves while reading it.
I think a lot of things resonated with all of us.
Okay, that's good.
This is Pete. I enjoyed it very much. It really affirmed a lot of things I had been thinking about, and it was also fun. I really appreciated that it was relatively short, and I'm sure you were considering that for writing it.
Mm-hmm. You can have. There are a couple of things. And I write on the blog, the Enterprise Chess blog. Not a lot at this moment in time, but there are some articles there. There is one that's called "Losing a Limpet," which might be interesting also, and a couple of others. If you know, scan about the blog, there's some more about it, and I write there or in other places. So,
great. Well, thank you so much. This has been most enjoyable and very informative.
All right.
Well,
okay. Bye bye.
Take care. And
bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you.